This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can now grab as a podcast or download off our website at progressive.org. Today, for you U.S. history buffs, we're going to be talking about the Revolutionary War pamphleteer Tom Paine, but we're also going to take up current subjects like American exceptionalism that Paine himself discussed. And with me to talk about these subjects is Harvey Kay, professor of social change and development at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, and the author of Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. Harvey Kay, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
What got you going on Tom Paine?
I have loved Thomas Paine ever since I was a child. My grandparents lived in Brooklyn, New York, opposite the Brooklyn Museum on Eastern Parkway. And my grandfather was a trial lawyer in New York, liberal socialist kind of guy, and at home he had a little library, and whenever we'd be visiting my grandparents, if it was clear that my parents and grandparents didn't want me in the room, I'd wander their apartment as if it was an extension of the Brooklyn Museum across the street, and I would always end up in the back of the dining room where these books were. And I tell the story, and it sounds strange for anybody to remember being a 10-year-old reading Thomas Paine, but I remember looking at these books, and my grandfather had a set of them by and about Paine, and I thought, wow, who is this guy? And there was one book which today I know to have been, filled with crap. But nevertheless, this one particular book argued that Thomas Paine was the real author of the Declaration of Independence, not Thomas Jefferson. And there was something about being 10 years old and being able to go into school and arguing with a school teacher that they didn't know what they were talking about, that it wasn't Jefferson. And that just began. And then in high school, one read Rights of Man and Age of Reason. One thought about politics and religion. And for years, I just thought of Paine as my hero. And then in the 90s, I had an opportunity to write a little article about Paine. It turned into a young adult biography, and I just couldn't give him up.
He's been with you.
Absolutely.
Now, your grandfather or grandmother, having that collection of Tom Paine, were these the kind of people that had books as decorations, or did they actually read those books?
No, they read those books. My grandfather devoured books. In fact, I often thought he should have probably been a college professor, but he was such a good trial lawyer, I wouldn't have wanted to pull him out of the courtroom.
Well, give us a little insight into Tom Paine. I didn't know much about his biography, or if I'd learned it there in high school, I'd forgotten it until I picked this back up. He was born in England.
And one thing that's interesting to consider is he wasn't a sort of young radical. He came to the United States. He was already almost 40 years old.
And he came late. It was near the time of the Revolution.
Right. He came in very late 1774. He had had a career in England that included corset making and privateering. And
what is privateering?
Privateering, well, the British government, other governments, used to license captains of ships to act on behalf of the government to go out and prey on enemy shipping. And it was like a licensed piracy, and you would attack the enemy's shipping. You would get a commission, basically, for what you brought back in. And Paine learned how to fight at sea. But it was great, because he learned, obviously, a lot about solidarity. He probably learned how to curse as well. And it made a major difference, I think, in his thinking. But he really wasn't a radical before he came to America.
You suggest that his background, the fact that he was not from the landed class, had a lot to do with his
writings. Right. I mean, his father was an artisan. He comes out of a working class background. And though his parents were really committed to his getting an education, they had to pull him out of school at 13 because they couldn't afford to keep him in there. And they apprenticed him to his father to learn corset making. And as I said, I mean, he learned what it meant to make an honest living. He had a series of adventures. He actually had a series of failures in England. He also got involved He ended up a tax collector for a while, and his fellow tax collectors were so badly paid, it was not unusual for them to also be rather corrupt. But they decided rather than pursue corruption, it would be smarter to lobby and pursue a labor campaign.
But he himself was nailed on a charge of corruption, wasn't he?
They said that he had failed to properly inspect the materials that he stamped, although there are some biographers who say that he might well not have been guilty, that he may have been playing the fall guy for his own boss. But, if I can just say, so he leads a labor campaign in England, which is destined to fail because the last thing the British government is ever going to allow was a labor campaign in the late 18th century. And they fired him from the Excise Commission.
And was this a campaign for unionization or higher wages?
Higher wages, and, or at least better benefits to keep him going. And he spent a year in London, which is a time in which he re-encountered Ben Franklin. And having been sacked, as the English would say, Franklin said to him, you know, maybe you ought to go to America. We could use people like you there. But he didn't necessarily imagine Paine would ever play the revolutionary role that he did.
Now, you say when he got here, he wasn't a radical. What radicalized him?
America radicalized him. I mean, he came over here carrying a certain kind of, you know, he hated the British government by this time. There's no doubt about that. I don't think he actually expected that he would love something again. And he gets off the ship in Philadelphia. And when he moves around Philadelphia, what he sees is, I mean, the guy somehow responded immediately to what he saw as revolutionary possibilities. He saw far less he didn't see poverty in America. He saw slavery, which was one of the first things he wrote against, but he saw opportunities, possibilities, and he was really impressed by the way in which Americans organized themselves to resist British impositions. That really fascinated him. He actually believed that that showed that they could accomplish much more. They could turn this country or these 13 colonies into an independent nation of a democratic sort. In its own fashion, as a kind of, you know, it's kind of radicalism which sees opportunities out there and recognizes that there are ways of bringing about social change that don't depend merely on anger.
I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. My guest today is Harvey Kaye, professor of social change and development at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay and author of Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. What got him to write Common Sense, and why was it so popular?
Well, he had been given the job of editor of a new magazine, the Pennsylvania Magazine. And I'm sure, Matt, you would like this fact, okay? As the editor of a magazine, he not only got a chance to write some pieces himself, he was able to bring together pieces that would speak to American experience.
Got to say, it made me very envious to be a magazine editor like that, and then someone who writes a pamphlet that just changes the course of history.
Well, what happened was he first wrote against slavery in America. He said, "Look, we Americans, you know, we Americans are decrying British tyranny. We're, you know, claiming we defend liberty and freedom. Well, let's put our money where our mouth is and let's abolish slavery." And this brought him to the attention of some of the more radical New England members and Philadelphia members of Congress, one of whom became a good friend of his. And when Paine responded to Lexington and Concord by declaring his commitment to the American cause, the conversation begins. Take your pen, Thomas Paine. Start talking about American possibilities. Now, everyone warned him, don't talk about independence. Don't talk exactly about revolution. But Paine was not going to be held back. He started to envision a real revolution. But for him, a revolution was far more than independence. Separating from Britain was not a revolution. He said, look, it was just a matter of separating from Britain and creating some new kind of European model over here. It was no revolution at all. He argued in Common Sense for something far grander. He was going to argue for making a Republican democratic society.
In fact, it was too radical for a lot of the people who went on to sign the Declaration of Independence.
Oh, absolutely. The likes of John Adams and the others, they welcomed Paine's call for independence because they didn't have the guts to do it themselves. But they were terribly worried, fearful of the kind of radical and popular aspirations Paine was expressing. As a working-class guy with a remarkable pen, he was expressing, or as the academics say, he was articulating Americans' unspoken aspirations, especially working people's aspirations. And the prospect that they would have working people who might actually be running a new government scared the likes of Adams and Gouverneur Morris and Alexander Hamilton, who comes in a bit later.
Tell me about that magical pen. How did he get such a wonderful writing style, such an effective writing style?
If we could can it, we'd be in really good shape. And one only can sort of make assumptions. One of the assumptions is that he learned Shakespeare and Milton in school. He learned from his father about the English Revolution, when the English in the 17th century basically showed the French how to take off the head of a king. Again, he learned about working class aspirations because he himself was working class. He had been on board ship. And I think the mix is really fundamental. But you know what's interesting? The few things that he wrote before he came to America did not resonate with that kind of progressive, radical optimism that he found in America. So there was something about American experience which really excited him. It just turned on that pen of his.
What was his role during the Revolutionary War?
Well, after having written Common Sense and having, you know, brought about this kind of revolutionary turmoil, he immediately enlisted in one of the Pennsylvania militias, which brought him into New York with the militia. He eventually ends up writing a really even more important, well, not more important, equally important pamphlet, The Crisis. And it's in The Crisis that those lines appear that become probably the most quoted in American history. These are the times that try men's souls. I mean, it's so quoted, you not only find politicians trying to grab hold of it, you also find baseball, football, and basketball coaches and sports writers quoting it.
It's entered into the realm of cliche.
Probably.
No. So he
In fact,
was,
if I can just tell you, yeah. I met a black disc jockey from New York one day, and he said, oh, so you like Thomas Paine? He said, I love Thomas Paine. I used to open my show with, these are the times that men try soul.
There's a little flip. He, after the revolution, he went to France and was involved, first of all, in justifying the French Revolution right. in an intellectual and philosophical yeah. argument with Edmund Burke. But then he fell afoul of the French Revolution, at least of Robespierre.
Right.
Tell me about that.
Well, there was no question about his love of revolution, Paine. But he didn't go first to Europe in favor of revolution. He went back, at Franklin's suggestion, to raise money so that he could build an iron bridge. But history seemed to find Paine wherever he went. And when the French Revolution erupted in July 1789, Lafayette, who was the original moderate leader of the revolution, invited Paine to come to France to witness the revolution unfold, and Paine was very much involved in it. And as you said, when Edmund Burke attacked the revolution, Paine responded with the great pamphlet, Rights of Man. Now, the French revolutionaries assumed that Paine would go along with anything that, you know, that was on the agenda, but Paine always opposed capital punishment. And when the king was tried, and he had been elected an honorary citizen and then a member of the National Assembly, Paine stood up in the assembly, and though he avidly supported trying the king, he stood up and said, we should not execute the king. We should send him to America so he can learn what it means to be a Republican and a Democrat. And so that it sounds funny to us today, but that really upset the Jacobins, and they decided that they couldn't afford to have him hanging around. He was much too much of a thinker and a writer. They threw him in prison.
And he almost got executed.
They wanted to take his head off, and it was if you allow for miracles, it was something of a miracle that he survived. He was terribly ill in prison, and his cellmates talked the guards into allowing them to leave open the door at night to get additional air into the cell. Well, they didn't realize that it was that night where the other guards were coming by marking the doors of the condemned for guillotining the next day. And they marked the wrong side of the door. So the next morning when the door was closed and the executioner's team came by, they walked right past the room that Paine was in.
The X was on the inside.
The X was on the inside. You've got it.
That's straight out of Dostoevsky, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's just fabulous. And Paine later is still in prison. And a conservative American diplomat named Gouverneur Morris made little effort to get him out. And then James Monroe came over and finally got Paine out of prison.
Now, the terror of the French Revolution, did that make Paine reconsider at all his enthusiasm?
You know, it's interesting. It did many people. And Paine actually never lost that enthusiasm for the French. He always thought that something could be redeemed of it. In fact, in 1795, amongst the other things he wrote a dissertation on government in which he was arguing with the more moderates who've now taken over the French government, saying that you have to extend universal suffrage. And he was demanding that all have the right to vote, that they not divide into an active citizenry and a passive citizenry. So Paine kept hoping. Paine was one of these undaunted types. He could not be suppressed.
I'm speaking with Harvey Kay, professor of social change and development at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. Harvey Kay is the author of Thomas Paine and the Promise of America, a book that's getting a lot of notice. I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. Harvey, I wanted to bring this toward the present and just throw a few criticisms at you.
Sure.
I'm sure you're very adept at fielding them.
Let's hope so.
The first is this book, this biography, this re-looking at Thomas Paine suggested to me that this is kind of a return to the great man view of history. In fact, you have a quote of William Bennett in there saying, we need to relearn our history. We need to relearn about the great leaders in our background.
But please remember, if I can just interject, The next thing I said after quoting Bennett is that he and I have a very different understanding of American history. I mean, I would never subscribe to the great man view of history, unless we want to throw in the great American radical tradition as the really great folk, and there I'm willing to buy in.
So you don't think that the criticism of this style of history is something that invalidates this approach of yours?
Well, you know, I've asked myself, why is it? Why is it that pain was supposedly forgotten? I mean, for 200 years, conservatives tried to suppress Paine's memory. And there's no doubt they feared his pen. They feared the arguments he made. They feared the really revolutionary heritage that America established in that 1776 moment. Okay, but then I started to realize, well, why? You know, he was never forgotten. But I discovered free thinkers, abolitionists, the working man's movement, the suffragists, the populists, the progressives, the socialists. Cut me off whenever you want. I mean, in every generation, American radicals redeemed Paine's memory.
Lincoln too, you said.
Lincoln too. Walt Whitman. I'm happy to name names in this particular case. And here's the thing, though. Historians repeatedly ignored not only Paine. Keep in mind, historians for generations were themselves out of upper crust families. Okay, it's only been really the past generation. Maybe that's the one gift my generation of historians has made, in which we've begun to ask questions from the bottom up. So as we've recovered the story of radicals from Paine to Emma Goldman, you know, to the SDS and the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, the Winter Soldiers, what I found was those folks in every generation had redeemed Paine's memory and kept alive that kind of radical democratic spirit. So really, when Bennett said, well, we need to, you know, sort of reappreciate or renew our sense of American history, I'll buy into the line. It's just, let's remember the kind of history that we need is that kind of radical democratic history, not the history that tells us presidents alone are the bearers of America's past.
Well, it leads me to my next criticism of the book, which is this exaltation of American greatness, of American exceptionalism. And you use that term quite explicitly several times.
Absolutely,
in the book.
Absolutely. I plead guilty.
So let's hear from the defense, though.
Well, I think, okay, well, here, look. I mean, I can understand your reservations.
Express the first reservation.
Sure.
One reservation is that it falsifies the history at the beginning. This is the radical critique of the founding of the Republic, that it was more of a propertied slaveholding and in the South and commercial interests in the North, the Charles Beard theory and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one aspect. It's not the most serious one that I have, but we'll get to that. I just wanted you to deal with the first part, though.
Okay, well, for a start, okay. Let's never get one-dimensional in our thinking. Okay, this radical critique that the nation was founded by slave owners in the South and bankers in the North or whatever, I mean, that's a complete misrepresentation of the American Revolution. The American Revolution was made from the bottom up. There wouldn't have been an American Revolution if it hadn't been for the fact that people from the bottom up were demanding change. Okay, I mean, even in their own fashion, those slaves, whether they sided with the American cause or sided with the British, they were demanding a change and end of slavery. If we come to the North, these artisans, they knew what they were struggling for. They were struggling, one, for democratic possibilities. Two, they were, in many cases, farmers and artisans alike were struggling to bring to America a separation of church and state. So what those folks were fighting for was going to be something completely different than the likes, say, of a Washington or, for that matter, even Jefferson for all of his rhetoric. Okay, I mean, the fact is that these guys said, and women, said, we're going to create something never before seen. When they responded to common sense, they were not responding to a call for independence. They were responding to a call for revolutionary democratic change.
But little bit of that revolutionary democratic change and some of the blueprints that Paine himself sketched out, according to your book, weren't realized and actually were stifled at the Constitutional Convention.
Absolutely. But here's the thing, and this is one of the things I want to say, and maybe this will lead us then into the points I think you want to take up, and that is, let's never think one-dimensionally. Let's remember that there are ideals that have motivated generations, and those ideals sometimes come to be realized. Sometimes they come to be realized, and the irony of history is that we realize they weren't as good as we thought they were. But let's also remember that we're talking 1776, okay? And there's no defense of slavery. There's no defense of exploitation. Okay. But it's also the case that if we're going to look at it merely in terms of the so-called, you want me to defer to the great man role of history. That's what Charles Beard was all about. He said, oh, if I got the right beard, sorry. Okay. I mean, we're talking here, this idea that it was bankers and landowners. That's a great man view of history. It's just an angry view that that David McCullough, the opposite of David McCullough. David McCullough gives the smiling view, and you want me to have the sort of angry view of the great man. Well, that's not American history. American history is about radicalism. It's about making equality, democracy, freedom, and it's about extending and deepening that. And if you look at 230 years of American history since Paine wrote Common Sense, that's what you'll see. Sorry.
No, that's good. It's a good defense of social history. But I'm sure there's a social history or people's history of the founding of the republic that has other characters coming in and feeding this stream in addition to Paine, though you say right now that Paine wasn't, you know, the only one going there. And I'm a sucker for biography, so I enjoyed the biography, let me say, right up front. Thomas Paine and the Promise of America is an interesting book.
But it's even interesting, Matt, I know I keep cutting you off, but it's even interesting to think that so many of these intellectuals of the 19th century that we're actually taught in school, okay, who were made to almost revere, you know, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Walt Whitman, Herman Melville, Abraham Lincoln. These guys were radicals. I mean, over and over again, Ralph Waldo Emerson, you know, in his own journals and notebooks says, you know, Jesus may be good, but Paine's the guy who liberates us. Walt Whitman, he wanted to be Thomas Paine. Herman Melville, every one of the books, I'll show you the Paine I'd influenced. I'll even show you the lines that he's actually quoting Thomas Paine, right all the way through to Billy Budd, the one that didn't get published till, you know, decades after his death. Abraham Lincoln, you can hear Paine echoing through him. Now, look, I mean, we have to reclaim that history.
The other argument, though, is something that I feel even more strongly about, and that is the claim of American greatness, American exceptionalism. And for me, it's a problem because, first of all, I don't believe in patriotism because I think patriotism is a dangerous concept. But beyond the philosophical is the realistic, and that is, you know, George W. Bush says the same thing. You know, we're a great country. We have this called by history to perpetuate freedom and spread
around the world.
It's interesting,
you know, undeniably, okay? Look, but you'd be the first to agree that there's a difference between those who mean it and pursue it and those who do it in order to, you know, as a subterfuge, as a way of, or better yet, as a way of sort of rallying people because they know that Americans believe in freedom and then using it in a fashion that neither you or I would subscribe to.
But is it a, maybe Bush believes it. You know, maybe he does. He thinks he's getting the word from God and he thinks we're ordained by God. This is something Paine wouldn't go for, but he thinks that America has this special historical calling.
Look, Paine believed America had a special calling, but he was very clear about what that calling was, okay? He says, look, America, first and foremost, should be an asylum for mankind. Freedom-loving people should be able to find themselves in America and experience that freedom. And America should be a model to the world. A model to the world. Surely you'd want America to be a model to the world. What else are we going to be about if we're not going to be pursuing freedom, equality, and democracy for ourselves and to offer the hope and the possibility that others might well? Well, that doesn't mean we are achieved. You know, Henry Demarest Lloyd, the late 19th century progressive and socialist, he said, you know, it's interesting. People talk about, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. And they said, oh, no. The price of liberty isn't eternal vigilance. It's in every generation. We have to extend freedom, equality, and democracy so that our children have more of it than we have of it. You got to think historically. You got to think, dialectically even.
The interesting Harvey Kay, who's the author of this interesting book, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America, is that you cite Ronald Reagan. You applaud Ronald Reagan for, in a sense, rediscovering Thomas Paine.
I cite Ronald Reagan because he knew that Americans have a sense of optimism that can be harnessed, in our purposes, in his case, for less than the good, but in others, for the good.
But I think Reagan believed in the city on the hill, too, and wasn't subterfuge for him.
Yeah, but in his city on the hill, you've got ghettos surrounding the hill.
I know, but that's the problem with this.
No, you see, you're taking rhetoric. No, look, no magazine publisher should have such a one-dimensional view of language, okay? You've got to understand that, if you're going to change the world, you're not going to do it merely by way of getting angry, and you're not going to do it by way of accusing your fellow Americans of failing to appreciate what can be possible. You're going to find in their experience the possibilities themselves, and you're going to harness that. And that's what Paine was about.
But he also was about this missionary impulse, which is exactly Bush's expression as a messianic militarist. And I think there's something in that
impulse. Well, you know what? Thomas Paine believed that America should be, as I said, an asylum to mankind, a model to the world, and a champion of freedom, equality, and democracy. But he warned America should never be a bully. he argued in favor of multilateralism, not unilateralism. Look, maybe the difference between us is the difference here in the sense that I'm a democratic internationalist. I accept that, okay? But a democratic internationalist, I don't subscribe to merely for the sake of going out and punching everybody else in the nose until they look like Americans. You're a knee-jerk, if you don't mind, I think you have a knee-jerk response that says, no, we have to back. We can't do anything but create ill in the world.
Well, I think it's theoretically possible, but I think in the here and now and in the here and before for the last 30, 40 years, we have been, by and large, creating ill. And that this theory of American exceptionalism is merely a blanket evil that we're doing.
We have to be careful. Look, American exceptionalism should never be that America is better than everyone else. American exceptionalism means we have a responsibility to ourselves and to others.
But it does mean that we're better than other people.
Wait, but a responsibility means first we must bear witness to ourselves. You know, like I remember back in 1991, this will shock people, I supported the Gulf War in 91. But I was more than prepared to put Reagan and Bush on trial for what they had done in the 1980s. But I would never have allowed. But I always believed that Saddam Hussein had a regime that needed to be taken out. The fact was, however, it's how you did it, how you pursued it, and moreover, who else would go on trial?
Well, leaving aside the Iraq War, which is a huge debate, even the first Iraq War, where James Baker dotted the I's and crossed the T's, but yeah. they didn't want Saddam Hussein to leave Kuwait.
Oh, I will never defend. Don't put me into. I would never defend the folks we're about to.
Then we have this group, and I just think the continual replication of this theory of American exceptionalism plays to
same American exceptionalism enabled Franklin Roosevelt, rather late in the case, to take the United States into the Second World War. And here's where I vehemently disagree with someone who you're very close to, Howard Zinn. Vehemently disagree with Howard Zinn on the question of the Second World War. And you know, I'm not a pacifist.
Well, we can't answer that one. But I do think, from my point, it's a mistake to stress American exceptional. I don't think America is greater than another country, than several countries in Western Europe, for that matter. And to claim that we are and to underline and accentuate that, I think feeds in the American mind this foolish megalomania, this unthinking megalomania.
I think if one views American exceptionalism as I think you do, that you may well be right. But that's not the American exceptionalism that I believe in. The American exceptionalism I believe in are the values that we ourselves use to make the case for a far more radical democratic politics than exists in America.
But then maybe we're using it as a subterfuge.
Well, frankly, I'm prepared to stand on the American radical tradition. I'm prepared to stand up with American exceptionalism. I believe America had, in its foundings, a certain kind of democratic impulse that Paine inscribed in those foundings. I believe that there is an exceptional purpose and promise in American life that you and I should be the first to grab hold of and cultivate.
Well, you know, I think you can find exceptional purposes in the Magna Carta and, you know.
Wait a second. Exceptional purpose in the Magna Carta, which was signed by the lords and the king? Come on, give me a break.
No, you can't. You can go through English common law.
Well, wait a second. I'm willing to say that there's something in the radical.
You can go to the French Revolution. Is that exceptional? How many countries are going to be exceptional?
I wrote about British Marxist historians before I came to this subject. In fact, it was the British Marxist historians who led me to be thinking in this fashion about the character of history.
Well, that's going to have to be the last word. It's been a fun give and take. I've been speaking with Harvey Kay, who is the author of Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. It's Matt Rothschild. You've been listening to Progressive Radio. Harvey Kay, thanks so much.
Thank you. This is very enjoyable. I hope we get to do it again.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.